So, my name is Rob, for anybody I haven't had a chance to speak with yet. And I'm one of the members of the LaRouche Youth Movement here in Montreal. So, just to introduce what we're going to be covering today, we're on the verge, as LaRouche has been saying for some time, in a sense, a punctum saliens, a change in world history, in really one of two directions. Either we go into some financial and economic disintegration, like we saw in the Great Depression, but magnified many times over, or we have a shift into a new humanistic culture, like what we saw coming out of the Golden Renaissance in Europe, or the Islamic Renaissance earlier in earlier times. Now, just to situate this, it's important because there are certain things occurring in the world which are generally not prevalent in the mass media, yet nevertheless are occurring. For example, Kosovo right now, the Balkans are again a flashpoint in the global strategic situation, where Kosovo is preparing to declare independence with the support of the United States, the UK, and NATO as a whole. At the same time, Russia has opposed this move as being a deliberately inflammatory maneuver, which brings to mind the years leading up to World War I. At the same time, Cheney was recently over in the Middle East promoting his war against Iran, and this idea that you're going to have a Sunni alliance against the Shiites in Iran and Syria and in Lebanon as well. Now, often when we speak to people about this on the street, there's a tendency to think about this as maybe an Iran issue, or it's an Israel-Palestine issue, or it's an issue about different groups in Lebanon, which to a certain extent is true, yet it doesn't really recognize the full implications of what is occurring, that this is in fact a Eurasian issue, and by extension a global issue, because the real question is whether or not there will be sovereign nation-states on this planet. Now, the fact that people don't recognize the historical implications, generally, of, say, the Kosovo crisis which is developing, or what we're seeing being played out right now in the Middle East, brings up a crucial point about history and how we understand history. So I'm going to be introducing the panel on this question of the historical fight over Eurasian development and the sovereign development of nations in this part of the world and elsewhere. Now, Russia has recently announced a plan to build a tunnel across the Bering Strait. Right, this plan was first discussed in the 1860s when Russia and the United States were in a very close relationship, which we'll get to a little bit later. At the same time, India and China are discussing building a railroad over the Himalayas, which would be one of the great engineering feats in the history of man. Elsewhere, you've got Pakistan discussing building a railroad through Afghanistan to finally connect this country, which has not a single kilometer of rail at this time in history, connecting it with the rest of the Eurasian continent. Now, this process began about 10 years ago, a little bit more than that. And there was almost an immediate response from the British. And one particular geopolitician in 1996 wrote an article that we quote in a special report we put out in 1997 on this issue of Eurasian development called the Eurasian Land Bridge. I just want to read this because it brings us to the essential point. This Euro-Asian railroad project involving China, Iran, and other countries requires us to revive Halford Mackinder and basic geopolitics. This has enormous geopolitical and strategic potential and is a real danger because, as you can see, it is not accessible to the Anglo-American maritime powers. What worries me is the economic multiplier effects of building railways. There is an enormous multiplier effect in terms of materials and logistical infrastructure. Think of the implications of this for movements of troops and materials. The United States should be very worried about such developments. We've come full circle now in the 20th century. It began with a Eurasian geopolitical threat, and it is ending with one. Go back to why Mackinder wrote his Geographical Pivot of Political History, which was published in Geographical Journal, the magazine of the Royal Geographical Society. It's not accidental that this was written in 1904, just as the Russo-Japanese War was beginning. What motivated him to write it was the building of the Trans-Siberian Railway. Now we've come full circle. Go back to the works of Haushofer, Hitler's advisor. He had one of the great geopolitical designs, the so-called inner line, free of Anglo-Saxon influence. It was a great design, but Hitler blew it with Operation Barbarossa. When I hear about China linking up with Iran and building a railway, and Russia becoming interested, I see this as the recreation of that inner line design in a new form. This must be monitored extremely closely. Please, go back and read your Mackinder. This is what he was warning about. Now,
who is that?
You may be asked, he's an unnamed fellow who published this article. At least we don't name him in there. But he was working out of Oxford, Cambridge. Now, you may be asking who Halford Mackinder was. Well, he was a member of Parliament for a while around the turn of the 19th century. He was also an economist at the London School of Economics. He held various positions, but he was in these circles, the upper echelons of the British elite, who were determining the direction that the empire was going to take at this time in history. Now, Mackinder is known as the father of geopolitics, but what he was writing in this book, The Geographical Pivot of History, was not really anything new. He was simply expressing what had really been the policy of the British Empire for several centuries, which is to prevent the overland development of railroads, things of this sort, in Eurasia. Now, if you think about this time, now this map is not very good. I don't know if people can really distinguish much from the back on this, but this is some sort of map of the world.
The Eurasia's chopped in half.
Yeah. Yeah, the British creation. But the point is, if you can't see this very well, just picture in your mind a map of the world and think about all of the strategic maritime channels on the planet and who controlled them. Whether it was the Suez Canal, Straits of Malacca, Singapore, right? Later on, the Panama Canal, the Malvinas Islands or the Falkland Islands, you know, the Northwest Passage, Gibraltar, South Africa, Australia, right? All of these major points were controlled by the British. And the idea was that you could control the planet by controlling these choke points, maritime choke points, only if there were no powerful nations that were developing on the interior of the continent of Eurasia. Now, Mackinder's policy was expressed, if I can find it here, in a very straightforward way. I can't find my note, but it's irregardless. The point was that he said, He looked at Asia, Europe, and Africa as a single, he called it the world island. And he said, now, really, whoever controls not the entire area, but basically this section here that's covered over, Central Asia and Eastern Europe, is able to control the world island. And whoever can control the world island, or that, you know, can control the world. The point being that you had a more than half of the world's resources were located in this territory, right? And what his point was that the and what he's expressing is the greatest fear of the British Empire throughout its entire history, which was a Russo-German alliance around centered on development. In particular, this time, rail development. Because you could move goods, as this fellow from Oxford says, right? It completely transforms the potential of this area of the world. You know, you had a Russo-Japanese war in 1905, and the Japanese, although they won some battles at the beginning, were about to get into trouble in this war because Russia, whereas if they had have gone to war a few years in the previously, Russia would have had no capability to defend its Siberian territories. However, with the railroad there, you could transport an army within a matter of less than 2 weeks across maybe 3,000 or 4,000 miles of territory. Now, what he's getting to, now McIntyre wrote this in 1904, now what happens very soon after that, right? You've got World War One. Now, some people say, and the history books generally say, that World War One was started with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand II. That was the cause of the war, right? But that's not really true. You might say that it was because you had a series of wars in the Balkans that drew in, you know, first Austria, and then Russia, then Germany, then France and England. But that's not really true either. You could say because it was because of the political manipulations of the British, which we'll get into in a little bit. But that's not really true either. Because the real cause of World War One was Lincoln's victory over the Confederacy. That may sound kind of strange. But the point is that what was World War One intended to prevent or to stop? What it was intended to stop was what had been unleashed by the victory of the Union in the Civil War. Because if you look at this period, now most textbooks, they'll completely glance over this, but if you really dig into the history, as we've done, as an organization, what you discover is that from the end of the Civil War through to basically the completion of the Trans-Siberian Railroad, this period, you have a blossoming of industry around the world. Japan adopts American methods of industrialization and development, which essentially, now when we talk about the American system, we don't mean capitalism as today, although that's what people at first think that we mean. What we're talking about is protectionist systems oriented towards the development of your own national economy, right, and the elevation of your population. If you've read the American state papers, you'll understand what the ideas expressed in the Declaration of Independence or in the preamble of the Constitution, what the American system is all about. Right, the elevation of humanity. So throughout the world, this is going. You have this explosion. You know, France is looking in the 1890s at developing all kinds of infrastructure systems in Africa to counter what the British are doing in South Africa and on. This whole region here. The British basically controlled the whole eastern coast of Africa, and the French had some colonies up in here. And a fellow, the foreign minister of France, Gabriel Hanotaux, is looking at how do you actually develop this whole area. right, and begin to end the colonial system as it's understood today. You had the fellow in Russia who was building the Trans-Siberian Railroad, Sergei Vita, who wrote, he gave lectures and wrote his own books on about American economists, you know, American system economists, people like Friedrich List or Henry C. Carey, you know, or Carey's father Matthew. You know, people you're never going to hear about today in an economics class, but they were the great arch rivals of Adam Smith and all the free traders, or free traders, whichever you prefer. So this is the dynamic of this period. Now, what this means for the British Empire is it can no longer maintain hegemony over the planet. Because what did it depend on? It depended on looting other countries, right? Getting them into these insane free trade deals. You know, I came across this quote once by an American writing in the 1840s. And he was comparing American to Canadian development. And he was saying, in the United States, whenever we've adopted our own policies of internal development and protectionism, we've flourished. And population has increased, and the overall wealth of the nation has increased. But that whenever we've adopted British free trade policies, we've come near to the verge of bankruptcy. And he says, whereas Canada, which has enjoyed the benefits of British free trade all of the time, it is it hasn't even had the benefits of you know, of the rise and fall in economic, the boom and bust cycle, you know, because it's always been so damn poor. It was too poor to have booms and busts. So, you know, and this is the point, that the world was moving in a direction that was no longer in line with the British. So what you have a series of political assassinations over this period. You know, I just found out a couple days ago from an associate down in the States. He has letters between the campaign manager of, Garfield, James Garfield, right, who was president, I think 1880 to 81. Now, this guy, his name was Wharton Barker. He was in communications with the Russians and also people in Canada, but which we have to investigate. But he was in communication with the Russians over creating an American-Russian alliance. And at the same time, he was involved in developing a rebellion, launching a rebellion in Ireland. So you'd have an Irish rebellion against the British, and then the United States and Russia would come in and back the Irish rebels to destroy the British Empire forever. That was in 1879 to 81. And this fellow was in touch with certain people in Canada about having a similar kind of insurgency here to create the conditions where Canada itself could become a sovereign nation free of the Queen. This is a history that is generally not taught in the schools these days. But nonetheless, when you see the letters, how do you refute the letters? You can't. So now the British response, it's important to understand the British method and what they do. And we've traced this even back to Venice in the Middle Ages, but this is not something we're going to get into now. But the point is, the method is the same. Empires always use the same method. It's called corruption, to corrupt your enemy. Look for the weakness in a society or in a culture. You look for the weakness and you use that against that culture. George Bush is a good example of this today. Now, King Edward VII, who came to power in 1901, he was a master geostrategist. He also happened to be the uncle of Kaiser Wilhelm II in Germany and Nicholas II in Russia. Now, one of Edward's biographers describes how Edward had extensively profiled neuroses, I guess, or the psychological defects of Kaiser Wilhelm II, and considered these amongst his most precious allies. So the thing is, you have a bunch of degenerate leaders in Europe at the time, and this king of England understands how to play these countries against each other. Right, so you've got this Kaiser Wilhelm II, who's a complete Anglophile, and he's got these massive insecurities because all he wants is to be accepted by the British royal family. More than anything else in the world, he wants to be loved. And, you know, to the point that at the end of World War I, 1917, when Germany is on the brink of destruction, you've had this senseless war, the Kaiser is still talking about how proud he was that in the Boer War, you know, when England was isolated from all of the world, you know, and you had a potential of at that time actually France and Russia and Germany ganging up on Britain, that he intervened to support the British cause in genocide against the Boers of South Africa, and how proud he was that he had saved the British Empire at that time in that treacherous moment in its history. You know, meanwhile, his country has been destroyed and he's about to be thrown out of power. You know, so this is the kind of person he was. Similar to a Bush, right, in his complete insanity. But the point is that the British created an alliance. They broke up what was developing as a continental alliance between people like Sergei Witte, Gabriel Hanotaux in France, you know, and the circles around, you know, Bismarck in Germany, and the offshoots of this. They broke up an alliance between these three powers, you know, who were oriented towards the development of Eurasia by manipulating these degenerate leaders or buying agents, you know, just buying people in the French government or buying people that were advisors to Tsar Nicholas II and getting them into this insane war. Now, and as for some of the other details to this, I mean, there's going to be time for questions at the end because it's an extremely elaborate, complicated period in history. But the key thing right now is to understand why that war happened. Because what do you see coming out of World War I? This process of development that is occurring, like the Trans-Siberian Railroad, Hanotaux's projects for Africa never happen. You know, the Ottoman Empire collapses, Britain seizes control over the oil wealth of the Middle East. You know, Germany is destroyed. You know, the industrial base of Germany is destroyed, and it's now being looted under the Versailles system. You know, in the United States, you have people like Teddy Roosevelt and other leaders like this who are not doing anything. They're just following the British lead. So that whole trajectory has been sabotaged, right? Now, and also don't think about World War I and II as separate wars, because they weren't. They're like one war with an interlude. Because World War II was the same basis. Remember, what were the British most afraid of? They were most afraid of an alliance between Germany and Russia because of German industrial might and Russia's control of that so-called heartland, what McNair called the heartland of the world island. That whoever controlled that heartland controlled the world island, whoever controlled the world island controlled the world. So when you think about that, you can understand World War II on a much higher level as being a second, in a sense, a replay of World War I. Different events, but the same intention, right, to again destroy these countries, right, in just endless warfare. However, there's a problem, because you've got this really troublesome guy in the United States named Roosevelt. The British didn't really like Roosevelt too much. You know, there's a book that was written by Roosevelt's son, Elliot, called As He Saw It, about Roosevelt's wartime experiences with Stalin and with Churchill. And Stalin was a much more likable guy. He probably had a better effect on humanity as well. Although that's, again, not what we're taught in schools. But, you know, you have two, there's two things I've mentioned from that. One of them is a meeting that happens between the Sultan of Morocco, Roosevelt, and Churchill. And Roosevelt, in French also, discusses with the Sultan about how, at the end of the war, the United States is going to help Morocco industrialize and become a sovereign nation, and also help the rest of Africa industrialize and put an end to the colonial system. And Eliot Roosevelt was at this meeting, and he describes how Churchill's face takes on this, you know, that you've got, you know, the whole spectrum of colors of red, you know, that are going on, to an almost apoplectic kind of, you know, his head's about to explode, you know, because he's sitting here and he's literally helpless before the power that Roosevelt represents to transform the planet. And he knows that he can't actually deal with this war without American help. And he also realizes that for the first time in maybe 30 years, 35 years, the leader of the United States is not a puppet of the British Empire. There's a second point in this book, which is indicative also, where Roosevelt and Franklin and Eliot are discussing various difficulties that Franklin has. And he tells his son about how there's really nobody in the State Department that he can trust, because they're all basically British agents. They're all closer to the British than they were to him. So, even though Roosevelt dies before the end of the war and before this post-colonial plan can be put into action, the full intention of World Wars I and II was not realized by the British, because at the end of the war, and by sometime in the middle of the 60s, Japan had been rebuilt, right? Russia was rebuilding, France and Germany were rebuilding, and you had this system and this Roosevelt legacy which had been created by his effect upon the world, which continued on. And they were not able to fully implement their plans. And the fact was, these very troubling nation states still existed. And this required a change of plans for the British, which we now call environmentalism. So, but to understand where environmentalism comes from, you got to understand who created it. You know, and let's take the World Wildlife Fund as an example. You know, one of the real, you know, big shots in this field. You got Prince Philip, you got Prince Bernard, right, card-carrying Nazi. You know, Churchill remarked that in World War II, the only guy who enjoyed himself was Prince Bernard. The only guy that had a good time. Churchill is said to have remarked that, you know, through the course of World War II, there was only one man who had a good time, and that was Prince Bernard. The guy who, up into the 30s, had been a member of the Nazi SS, but married a Dutch princess and had to give it up. So, and then you have people like Morris Strong, who's the mentor of David Suzuki, our cuddly Canadian environmentalist. And then you also have John Loudon, who ran Royal Dutch Shell for several decades. And you have Aldous Huxley. Oh, no, sorry, Aldous Huxley's cousin, Julian Huxley. Now, Julian Huxley, a case in point, was at the same time the president of the British Eugenics Society. Now, if people aren't familiar with what the eugenics movement was, this was basically quack science that was used to, you know, prove the superiority of the Anglo-Saxon race. And that basically, these Africans, I mean, you look at them, I mean, all they're good for, you know, the dancing, I mean, you look at them at it, as Huxley himself remarks when after a trip to Africa, you know, you look at one of these nigger camp meetings, and the dancing around, and the sweating, and the groaning, and the screaming, and the shouting, and man, how can you even imagine that these people are the equal of, you know, Anglo-Saxons? So the point was, eugenics was created back in the 1880s by people like Darwin. Darwin was a, you know, very important member of the British Eugenics Society. Then you have people like Thomas Huxley. You know, you had people like John Maynard Keynes, the so-called, you know, creator of Keynesian economics and the IMF. And he was the vice president of the British Eugenics Society in 1937. So anybody who tells you that Keynes was the primary model or advisor to Roosevelt, that Roosevelt was a Keynesian, I tell them, sorry, but you know, Roosevelt wasn't a racist. Now, thing is, why would these eugenicists, like obvious racists, create this environmental movement? Well, they had a problem, because these are the same guys that created Hitler. And the Nazi race policies came from Britain. And, you know, the Rockefeller family. I mean, the Rockefellers were financing Nazi scientists in the 1930s to do their research. You know, do research on you know, in different areas of genetics and things like this that they couldn't actually do in the United States. So they financed this stuff to be done in under the Nazis instead. But the point was that these policies were not just there in Germany, but they were put into the society, right, through these Anglo-American networks. But of course, you know, after World War II, eugenics was not such a popular thing. So, and Huxley, and I'll read one quote from an article that I put together a couple months ago on this subject, and people, we can get copies to them if they would like to look further into this. Now, I'd like to point out that before this specific section, which is in a published document by UNESCO, like what was it, Matt? The
Purpose and Philosophy of UNESCO.
Right. This is when Huxley was the first president of UNESCO. I think in 1946 or 47, he made this speech. Now, he starts this by saying, you know, civilization has been found to be generally dysgenic. As in, there's a tendency that for civilization to support people who would otherwise perish in the natural state of things. So civilization has been bad for humanity. Now that's a funny thought, really. To actually claim that the problem with human beings is civilization. It's like Bertrand Russell in his essay, The Impact of Science on Society. He says, you know, the agricultural revolution has probably caused more harm than good. What the hell? I mean, that's insane. David Suzuki, too, this guy says that where we went wrong is the agricultural revolution. We were more one with nature when we were living in caves and, you know, dying when we were 32 or something like this, right? Or earlier. So this is the kind of mentality that these guys have. Now, this is what Huxley says. He says, even though it is quite true that any radical eugenic policy, such as sterilization or euthanasia and stuff like this, will be for many years politically and psychologically impossible. It will be important for UNESCO to see that the eugenic problem is examined with the greatest care, and that the public mind is informed of the issues at stake, so that much that is now unthinkable may at least become thinkable. And this is one of the founders of the World Wildlife Fund. Now, as soon as the war ended, you got the creation of various conservation movements and stuff like this. The main policy was overpopulation, limited resources. And it's been the same idea for the last 60 years, really. That's it. That's what these guys push. It takes various guises, like global warming or the ozone scare or, you know, things like that, DDT. But the essential issue is this question of overpopulation. Now, it's funny that these guys say that the world is too full of human beings, because, as an example, I worked out some of the math earlier today, but this is funny. Take every human being on the planet. Give them a square meter to stand in, okay? You're going to squish them all together. How much space do you really think that human beings take up?
6 billion square meters.
Right, which is... Right. Now, that's a lot of meters. But you actually think about that territorially. You're talking about a strip of land, let's say 6.5 billion square meters. 65 miles wide and 100 kilometers, or 65 kilometers wide and 100 kilometers long. Now, I'm not sure what the total size of the island of Montreal is, but I'm not thinking it's much bigger than that. And somehow we've made the world too full.
I think it's a bit bigger.
Maybe a bit bigger.
But the same length, but double the height.
Meters, not kilometers.
We're going to put some of the people, we're going to put them in another island. You know, like, no problem.
Yeah, right. So, you know, you think about that, and man, I mean, when you put it into perspective and kind of toss out all the extreme talk of, you know, the oceans rising 20 meters and stuff like that, and you just think about it for a second, I mean, kind of puts it back into perspective. But the point is that this idea of overpopulation is not new either. I mean, this goes back to Thomas Malthus, right, who had been a major economist for the British East India Company. Right, which was destroying India. They were basically the company in charge of looting India for 150 years. And Malthus, he was saying that the food supply grows algebraically or arithmetically, and population grows geometrically. So inevitably, I mean, the population is going to expand faster than food, and you're going to have collapses, and that's why India is poor. It's because there's too many people in India for the amount of food they can produce. Not that we're looting them to death. I mean, look at today. What do they say about Africa? Africa's overpopulated. That's why they're all poor. Not because we've looted them for 400 years and we've imposed upon them a kind of backwardness. So that's what we're dealing with. And when you want to know who Al Gore is, this is who he is. In his movie, if any of you have seen his movie, he shows a population graph. This is very useful, as a pedagogical demonstration of why we're not so fond of Al Gore. Because Al Gore says that this population curve is the problem. Now, just like David Suzuki says that only cancers grow exponentially. Right? Therefore, human beings are like cancer. Whereas what LaRouche discovered and what we argue is that, well, actually, what that curve represents, what that tells us, is actually what is beautiful about mankind. That we can actually, we are the only creature in the universe that can transform its own relationship to the universe, willfully.
Willfully.
And this is what it comes down to. This is what we're going to be dealing with in the other presentations. This fundamental question of how we transform that relationship. But if you look at what Al Gore is saying, really, he's just a racist. I mean, he made his career off of as an FBI informant against black, civil rights leaders. Back in he started in 74, right, running slander campaigns in Tennessee. In 1998, he prevented South Africa from, producing generic AIDS drugs for its population. So who knows how many, hundreds of thousands or millions of people, their deaths are on his hands. But this is what is the environmental movement really? LaRouche made a point in his last webcast. He said, you got to understand, the left is the right. That what we're seeing right now in history is between, say, the neoconservative movement, right, and the cartelization of the world economy, right? And if you've been following Canadian business section of even the Globe, which is not that great, but if you've been following this, you'll understand that this past week, the world surpassed the $2 trillion mark for mergers and acquisitions this year alone. Last year, the total was $3.49 trillion in either corporations merging or one eating up, devouring the other. Right? This is unprecedented in all of history. The rate of acquisition that's occurring right now. And this year we're set to go probably somewhere close to $5 trillion. But the point is, you look at every major sector, whether it's retail or strategic sectors such as oil, banking, mining, transportation, it's all cartels. Like under Nazi Germany. Cartels, that's the direction the world is moving in. That's fascism, right? These are the networks that created Hitler. But at the same time, you've got the left, the so-called left, the environmental movement, advocating policies that would destroy nation states and destroy the ability of nation states to be sovereign. And when you see the guys that led the movement, like Prince Philip or John Loudon, right, who ran Royal Dutch Shell, or Prince Bernard, these guys are the right. But you got people who don't understand history. They don't understand that history happens in long arcs over centuries. That you can't know anything if you just think about history as in what's happening now, or last year, or even 10 years ago. But you've got to think in terms of centuries. Like, what was the cause of the First World War? Right? How many people think about it in terms of the cause was the Civil War? Or the fact that really the cause was the American Revolution? Because the American Revolution was the reason that the British orchestrated the Civil War, which is also something that's not commonly taught in schools. So this is what we're facing now, and if you want to understand what Al Gore represents and why we make these inflammatory signs about him, this is how you've got to look at it, right? What this represents, just as this right-wing fascism is the end of nation states. Because if you can't produce for your people, right? How do you produce? How do you consume if you don't produce? Right? Are you sovereign if you don't own your industries or if you don't have control over your natural resources? Like, is Canada a sovereign nation? It doesn't act sovereign. Right? Not if we sell everything off. Right, if we can't control our own destiny. And this is the fundamental issue now. But enough of all of this stuff. Let's actually get on to the more uplifting parts of the... Now that we've got the nasty stuff out of the way, we'll get on to the question of how we actually deal with the financial crisis that these financiers and the environmental movement have got us into, and then how we launch the Renaissance that comes after.
Thank you.
And if there's questions and stuff like that, if people want to hold them or write them down, we can discuss at the end more about this stuff. I think we'll continue for now. Maybe we'll see if maybe after the next how people feel, and we could take maybe 5 minutes or something like that.
Not as a player, Just make your hand like a video presentation or something. You get the MP3 off this. All right. Just bring your pictures up there.
Oh, okay.
Population chart, then the world, and then we'll go back to the
same thing.
No, the one I played.
Are you ready, Mr. Speaker?
I don't know. I doubt it. But
despite what happened,
or because
you get the basic theory, like
guys, no, not this. Rob touched on that. Yeah, we'll do the JFK thing again. Yeah.
I see.
Not the DMC. Not the DMC. You start with the limits to growth, and then go to the population. The limits to the population chart.
Do you know what the
Davis
is
saying? No, I don't want to do this. I think Rob's going to hit it. Je peux vous envoyer un email si tu veux.
C'est pas ça l'email?
Ah. Je peux vous donner la mienne si tu veux. C'est juste mon outline. C'est juste la première page.
Pour l'écriture.
That's just my course outline. I mean. If he wants to use it. Yeah, sure. Oh, tu peux l'avoir. J'ai deux copies. Right. So, hi. So Abiel had a few minutes to get some coffee and some cookies, and if not, then you'll have a second chance after I'm done, before Val gets up with the how to create a renaissance. And I mean, what became quite apparent, I think, in the last presentation is that obviously the British aren't exactly necessarily what we get off of the tabloids or the cozy little funny people that live in a big castle across the sea that were sold, and there's another history, another side to history that people would be really, really foolish not to take into account when going about their day-to-day decisions. Because, I mean, obviously, problems go a lot bigger than what we see around our lives, around our backyard, and it's very, very important, I think, that we begin to get a handle on making our decisions, taking this history into account, and also using our ability to reason what, you know, how to correct these things, what human nature is. Because what you find a lot, I mean, as a political organizer with the LaRouche movement, there's a lot of time. A lot of time is spent trying to discuss economics with people who have largely been seeing their world through a filter. And so, when you describe something to the effect of our economic system is not sustainable, we're in a complete crisis. Our economy is bankrupt. Why that is? There's a bit of a disconnection because, when you get down to it, there's still a lot of money to be had. You actually get this. There's teachers, economics professors who will look at you with a blank stare after you describe that our infrastructure has disappeared and we actually rely on the exploitation of half the world's population. And we don't put any money into infrastructure whatsoever. And they'll say, what do you mean this is a crisis? There's more money now than ever. And that's a bit of that's a reflection of a particular way of thinking, which we really have to begin to discuss, and to discuss why that thinking is embedded in a population to the extent that it is. Because ultimately here, the most fundamental thing, and the only way you can have economic policies like we see today, where you've had a continual 35, 40-year progression or regression of our physical economy. The Montreal infrastructure is a good example. Our hydroelectric grids were last touched before the 60s. Our sanitation is no better now than it was 40 years ago. It's like that for most parts of the world. And yet we're very wealthy, or we appear to be very wealthy. We can buy whatever we can do whatever we want, in a sense. And so to have a policy become norm like this requires something inside of the population in order for it to be sustained. And we have overt depopulation policies at play in our lives right now. And normally, I suppose, if you were in a healthy society, an optimistic society about the future, you wouldn't necessarily allow these ideas to become so prevalent. So there requires a bit of a support base in the way that we're thinking about ourselves. Because, I mean, normally people would get up and fight this sort of thing. I mean, we have our lives to go through and our debts to pay and our shows to watch, and we're trained to think in terms of the small, like take care of what you know. But if we did, I think, understand what was going on, people would get up and act. And I think that's really one of those things that hold us all back, is this conception of man. Because if man is really just another virus or bacteria that multiplies in a finite jar, like David Suzuki so eloquently expresses in most of his presentations, then there's nothing really to fight for. You might know that there's corruption. You might have a sense that there's, an orchestration of maybe Wall Street bankers and London City operatives paid for Mussolini, and they put massive quantities of cash into Hitler's coffers, and maybe they started World War I too, and maybe the central banking system is privately owned. I mean, these things are true, but it doesn't really get you to act to stop it. If the case in your mind and in the general population's mind is that, well, this is human nature, we're just doomed to go through this pattern, right? Like, look at civilizations that have passed. Like, look at those civilizations like Rome that have collapsed. And I mean, ultimately, maybe we are in a jar. Maybe we are like little bacteria that just multiply exponentially, like Thomas Malthus says. I mean, there's a book that came out in 1972 called Limits to Growth that really set our economy and our the social, well, the way that we think of ourselves really on a new direction here. And this thing pretty much revitalized the old theory of Malthus, the theory that, food or populations, human population increases exponentially while food on the earth and resources increase, if at all, arithmetically. So this thing revitalized that, brought that back from the grave, and made it really mainstream. The population chart that went hand in hand with... Yeah, that one. No. Great.
That one.
Yeah. I mean, what this book basically put out there was this idea that there is a certain finite carrying capacity to this crystalline jar, perfect jar called Earth, that at some given point in the future, there's a certain carrying capacity that we will not be able to continue to grow. Sure, we've grown to a point, but there's a certain point we got to stop that. And, you know, we'll use up all the oil and we'll use up everything else that we need. And so if we don't have oil and we don't have these resources that we rely on for the technologies that we have access to today, well, we'll all be dead. If we don't increase, you know, there's no way of finding a new, better form of energy that allows the human population to continue on this natural path of growth. And certainly there's no way to increase our agricultural methods. We got a finite cap. And it was called the carrying capacity. So that carrying capacity is an important idea, because that's completely negating. It was built together with computer models, and it completely negates the human creative mind. There's no place for that idea. That it pretty much abolishes human nature. So if we are, you know, another chimpanzee or another bacteria, yeah, well, that's probably something that we'd have to look forward to. But then I think some vital ideas of what human is need to be clarified. And let's just see if maybe we're not a virus. as the British with their methods have deemed themselves, in a sense. Because we can't act like that. And certainly we do go through processes throughout history where we have exhibited this tendency to be a virus or be another animal. And let's just see, well, why was that? Because I think rather than looking in our backyards or making the changes for the very small, like, you know, David Suki or most of the environmentalist movement will say that we have all these crises on our hands, 2 miles of ocean waters above our heads in the near future, because we've developed and produced CO2. But we could buy a light bulb, or we could plant a tree. You know, or we could buy fair trade coffee, you know, to help out those Africans, give them a sandwich. But let's not think big anymore. That's not the issue. But I think now is a very good time to start thinking big. And in that, I think looking at the Earth and its existence for close to 5 billion years is a good place to start. And, you know, you've got this structure here, circling a sun, that within it didn't always have life. Didn't always have humans, didn't always have bacteria. At some point was completely abiotic. It had nothing going. But now looking at the Earth and looking at the progression, there was a period, there was a process of development there where you had, all of a sudden, life. You had bacteria that got more and more complex. And at a certain point, you had chimpanzees, you had animals, you had humans spring off that approach to greater and greater complexity. And at the beginning of that process of human existence, we were probably only a few thousand, maybe... And at some point, we're like a million, just like maybe any other animal. But then there's something about what we can do that the apes couldn't do that allowed us to change a certain boundary that nature had imposed on us naturally, like any other rabbit would have a certain boundary that the universe would say, "All right, you guys can stop." And rabbits would start eating their babies when they get across to a certain, when they exceed a certain capacity, and nature says when to stop. Six and a half billion people here. We didn't obey that particular law. We didn't, but maybe that wasn't really a law that applies to humans, because at a certain point we didn't have access to nuclear energy. We didn't have access to fuel, to coal, to even, we didn't even know how to use wood at some point, or use it to make fire. But in the progression of time, we slowly could exceed and harness these powers bit by bit to improve our ability to exist and subsist upon the earth and actually improve the earth. You can improve the agricultural methods, you know. People learn at some point, well, we're running out of food. We can't grow more food here. Maybe there's a process of irrigation or something we can work on. And, you know, all of a sudden now, instead of being able to only subsist on 10, you know, you can only carry maybe 1,000 people in a given area of land. Now you can carry 10,000 people with that new improved technology. Get onto a period of a windmill or something later on, much later on down the road, and you can carry more people still. You forget how to use you forget somewhere along the way how to use one of these things, and this happens from time to time, where one population or one generation forgets how to use something discovered in a previous generation. Well, they're going to encounter a bit of a wall. So then you have this process where we can change our boundaries that nature imposes by virtue of the fact that we have minds that can discover how the universe functions. And this is the kernel of LaRouche's economics. And the kernel is that humans are good, that it's a very natural, beautiful thing that we, like Rob eloquently said, that we do what we do, that we grow, that we have things like renaissances and industrial revolutions that allow us to expand our population. And this is what LaRouche, if you all start reading his writings and what we put out as a movement, you're going to start coming across these terminologies, and especially this one that I've just described, touches on the maximum relative population density, which is a necessary measurable component of human nature that we have to begin to take into account when looking at how to deal with our current economic problems. And the maximum relative potential population density is just that. There's a certain population density. There's a certain quantity of people that can be sustained in a certain area of land, a square kilometer, that can expand or contract depending on that which the population has access to, or what type of discoveries that population makes in relation to their environment. So if they, you know, you learn how to, once again, use fire, then all of a sudden your population boundary gets bigger and your density accordingly. Now, relative means, well, there's different parts of the world. There's the Sahara Desert and there's the Siberian tundra, and so you're going to have different... You can't just build a canoe around a lake in the Sahara, which will increase your population in one place, and then assume that canoe building discovery is going to help your Siberian tundra population in that same way. So there's a relative, based on the geographical location of the world and the environment, there's an idea of relativity there that has to be also taken into account. But then, once again, people just, you know, if we tend to look at history in terms of through a very pessimistic light, and that's what people usually do, they look at the civilizations that collapse or the wars to justify, well, yeah, look, human nature is bad. Look at the Byzantine Empire, look at Rome, or look at World War I or World War II. Look at, that's what we do, that's our nature, that's what we do. Right? So they'll justify an idea of what they see around them based on what they think caused these occurrences. And what they don't look at often enough is the fundamental type of thinking that was dominant around that time in civilizations past. And I think a good point would be to look at Rome, for instance. And in preparing this little class, I came across a few interesting little tidbits and that I thought I might share with you. Rome itself had a pretty incredible... Archaeologists have discovered a really interesting characteristic in that they had access to a lot of technologies. They didn't necessarily produce those technologies themselves, but there was a basic idea of hydraulics. They had little machines for puppets that did some entertaining stuff for the nobility. The Colosseum had signs of elevator systems, not like we have today, but there was this technology there. Yes?
Wasn't there like this big sewer system in Rome?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a hydraulic system used for the main city of Rome. Yeah. But when you look at the land itself, you find that while there were signs of even these basic mills, windmills, on occasion, largely they weren't put into use to maximize or create any development of the agricultural methods from one generation to the next around Rome. And you didn't have new technologies being cultivated for any reason other than bread and circuses for, you know, Colosseum or entertaining the nobility. Little coin-operated machines even existed then too. But you had a potential there to put this understanding of technology and nature to work to improve one's lot and one's capacity to exist, but it wasn't done. By and large. And why wasn't it done is one needs to look at how Rome operated. Under what economic system did Rome operate under? And you start seeing that their definition of wealth was the acquisition of more territory. It was an empire. It expanded. Its idea of owning property, just the value there ended in the quantity of slaves you had on that property of farming land or whatever, and there was no idea of improvement of that whatsoever. So, you know, putting mills to use didn't really come into play. Or cultivating the minds of your people weren't really an issue since they were a bread and circus society. So you have, once again, a situation in place now that's completely dominant in a civilization where the human mind is once again neglected in favor of a definition of value that is quantitative. This is my land. I need more land to be more valuable, and I need to keep my population happy in some way. And, you know, you tend not to use any of these real potentials in any way. And then you think back to today, and, you know, you look at all our requirements and our needs. We need to desalinate the world's waters. We need nuclear energy to really improve the lot of most people on the planet. And that requires plasma. Where do you find plasma mostly being used today? Well, flat screen, yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. Funny little parallel. So yeah, I mean, the life of the slave was really located, or the value of the life of the slave was located in its body and not its virtue of its humanity. So that nothing was cultivated. And then today, once again, you know, we have currently 3.5 billion people who live on less than $2 a day on the planet Earth. Now, after Rob's presentation, we can kind of get a sense of why that is, to a better degree. Because a lot of people fall into the trap of saying, well, maybe, and you get this a lot, where people will say, well, yeah, maybe the environmental movement did come from a certain policy of eugenics, and maybe Al Gore has demonstrated himself to be a racist, and you might be right about all this stuff, but at least he cares about the environment. Like, at least the environment's really up there right now. Isn't that important? I mean, that's finally the number one issue. And, I mean, ironically, we could say, yeah, you're kind of right. That, you know, a lot of people get trapped into that thinking that, well, at some point the world will be finite. We won't exceed, you know, we will just exceed the carrying capacity. But we don't realize that today, as it stands, we could supply, if we actually put our current level of technology to use, what we have right now in terms of fission, agricultural methods right now, magnetic levitation trains, we could feed at a higher quality, not even just feed, but we could create an environment where we could have over 30 billion people living at a higher quality of life. That's just right now. That's just if we put this stuff to work instead of having corporations till we discover something better. But we'd have to, yeah, we'd have to be human once again. You need some sort of an economic system that allows people to meet these challenges, though. But these these Sorry, I kind of lost my mind, lost my thought process there. It's okay. Meredith?
We could 30 billion people we could sustain right now?
Yeah, right.
With the new stuff.
Yeah, which is the current level of technology. But yeah, and if you didn't have companies, right, like Monsanto that currently burn thousands of tons of wheat per year just to make their value go up in the Dow Jones, which is the current operating practice, is that when there's a certain need to raise the value of a certain stock, a common practice for these people is to just burn stuff or use it for biofuels, you know, run a car that's more eco-friendly rather than feed any of these people that really do physically require these foods. Or move a corporation, I mean, or an industry out of Canada, where we used to be a producer nation, and move it to move it to Malaysia, putting out of work, you know, 20,000 auto workers or anything to that effect. It'll raise the value on the Dow Jones, but ultimately, does it have real value if it's just completely killed your future or your children's future to have a certain quality of life or job in that area? Well, that doesn't really matter. So then, you know, with 30 billion people, with the potential for that right now, we could ask ourselves, why is this happening? When only 60 years ago you had Franklin Roosevelt pushing for Bretton Woods policy, the policy of developing Africa, creating a fixed exchange rate so you can increase the flow of capital goods into the third world and end imperialism. When only a little bit after that, you had Eisenhower pushing the Atoms for Peace plan. You had John F. Kennedy pushing the Alliance for Progress to develop South America, end the exploitation there, build up and allow them to industrialize and benefit from what they make. That's revolutionary today. People won't even consider a lot of these very basically human ideas today. Allow a third world nation to benefit from what it makes. It's almost foreign. But yet you had his own brother, Robert F. Kennedy, too, who was pushing the same thing right as he declared his position for presidency of the America. So you had a certain trajectory being set forth and created that was completely ontologically opposed to everything that we have today. It was a trajectory of development and optimism. You had Apollo space missions that it required a huge quantity of money going into something that was impossible. There was no way when John F. Kennedy declared we would be going to the moon, and you know, he didn't know when. Nobody knew when. It was impossible, but it was done so that we could do and explore what was yet, you know, unimaginable or imaginable but impossible. And the quantity of benefits in return from that type of exploration turned out to be, in hindsight, by having a future orientation, every dollar spent got a $10 return on every investment in the long run. So you had a much greater return than any form of free trade system could ever offer. So yeah, people generally believe that, you know, we wouldn't have to have this conference even, because people generally believe that, you know, human nature was good. So what happened? I mean, ultimately we fell for a swindle. And a swindle just involved everything I just mentioned. We fell for a type of economic system that was based largely on rule of the jungle, every man for himself. Individual self-gain and emotions come before any form of principle. That became increasingly the dominant system, and we became a post-industrial society. And today you have people really, really happy over the idea that we don't have to get our hands dirty anymore. We're an information society. We're a services economy. We can raise the GDP in Africa by giving them a wireless cell phone. So give them microcredit. Give them the ability to connect online and but don't change the system anymore. Don't make waves, because look what happens to people who make waves, right? They get shot. So don't do that. I mean, that's the type of message that was indoctrinated into a whole generation of people now who don't.
We are all the cool food.
Yeah. Yeah. You introduce magnetic levitation trains, and all of a sudden people don't need a three-car garage anymore. You know, you have this idea that our whole society exists because we are consumers, and that if we didn't have the exploitation of the third world, our Walmarts would fall to pieces, our dollar stores. We have to locate our identities in these things. As long as you're preparing bikes. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that information's bad, but having a whole society based on not preparing the bike and just creating 3D models of the bike without making a bike. Huh? Communication's good. That's absolutely necessary. But that communication has to be done with a purpose to do something. And it's like in Rwanda, right? There was just this article of, you know, you had the genocide 12 years ago, and now you have an economist in Rwanda who went through it, and he's ecstatic over the fact that Rwanda is becoming a model country to basically showcase how this new economy can function even in Africa, where they're all 40% of Rwanda is now wireless. And he's saying it's so great now that we're a post-agricultural nation. We don't have to rely on that anymore because now we're wireless. I mean, that he's ecstatic. And it's called, ironically, he runs a development bank. So our definitions of wealth and development and these things are slightly problematic. So, yeah, I mean, over the years, we lost any form of protection. 1978, 79, through the Carter administration, I mean, most, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, who came from McGill, you had an operation that removed what government protection we had created since, you know, under Roosevelt, that kept our businesses at home. So you've had an operation increasingly to make the argument, in a sense, that we are a virus much more prevalent. Because when you look at the type of world that we've created, in a sense, we've imposed new boundaries on ourselves. Because just like when we expand them, we can impose them. And that type of economic system, if you impose boundaries like that, well, it becomes much, much more easy to convince people that, you know, that literally we are just, you know, a big universal joke. So yeah, I mean, there's those certain characteristics of societies that have functioned, and that, you know, we did get to 6.5 billion people not by living as law of the jungle and just by killing each other. We did get to this point and pushing this boundary from maybe 10,000 to this point through methods and by using the human mind in such a way that if you have societies that reflect this capacity of man's mind to do that, then you have all of a sudden an economic system that's anti-empire. All of a sudden, you have something that's actually worth fighting for, that we can make moves towards, because now there's a solution that otherwise wasn't there before if we didn't take this into account. So looking at those societies that do flourish, because the underlying structure, the curvature of the universe is one that we have to follow, if we understand it, then what's stopping us? And it's with this that, you know, we could look at the civilizations of that collapse, or we could look at the Renaissances and learn from, it's our decision which one we're going to learn from. And I suggest we start learning from the Renaissances that have elevated man in the darkest times. So it's with that I guess I'll leave it alone, and Valerie, if after a little bit of a break, can take it off.
So we can take 5 minutes.
Yeah, it would take 5 minutes. There's still some
cakes and cookies.
Yeah, cakes, cookies, coffee.